Mr. Burstein.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Daniel Burstein. I'm a third-year law student at the University of Chicago Law School, licensed under Illinois Supreme Court Rule 711. I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. James Rohde. About 13 years ago, this Court determined that Rule 408 of the Federal Rules of Evidence did not apply or was inapplicable to criminal cases. The Court recently reaffirmed this principle only several weeks ago in United States v. Ghilarducci. Despite this, the District Court excluded any references to...
What significance do you think we should give to the fact that the Judicial Conference of the United States appears and the Supreme Court appear to have a contrary view? The amendment to Rule 408 that took effect last December 1st is crystal clear that it applies to criminal cases.
Well, I believe so, and I believe if I understand the government's argument correctly, the government is asking that that the language of the recently amended Rule 408 be applied.
No, I'm not asking that question, because the rule that applies has got to be the rule that was in force at the time of the trial.
Yes.
But I'm asking the question, what is the bearing of the activity of the Advisory Committee, the Standing Committee, the Judicial Conference, and the Supreme Court of the United States, all of whom amended Rule 408 in the clear belief, and now the express language, that it applies to criminal cases?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I argue against the sort of, or I mean, even a very sort of textual application of Rule 408. I mean, the Supreme Court, even previously in Chambers v. Mississippi and Holmes v. South Carolina, warned against any kind of mechanical application of federal rules of evidence, even very clear ones.
I'm not asking questions about whether we apply it mechanically or open-ended. The question I'm asking is, what is the significance of the widely shared assumption, indeed shared by everybody except some judges on the Pruitt panel, that Rule 408 applies to criminal cases? That is, by the way, what Rule 1101 says. Rule 1101 says that Rule 408 and most of the rest of the rules, with a few exceptions, apply to criminal cases. And that's been there all along.
It has. I mean, from my understanding, I mean, that Pruitt, I mean, addressed 1101, and 1101 does state that the federal rules of evidence, I mean, generally apply across the board to criminal and civil cases. Generally, I mean, looking at the particular language of Rule 408, the Pruitt Court was convinced that the specific language of 408, as it existed at that time, led to the conclusion that it didn't apply in criminal cases. It's speaking to proving the validity of a claim.
You're not really coping with my question.
I understand your question, Judge.
The people who made the changes to Rule 408 in 2006 didn't appear to think that they were making a change in Rule 408. That is, the committee note doesn't say we need to change Rule 408 in response to Pruitt. Mm-hmm. The language of 408 and of the committee note appears to reflect a belief consistent with Rule 1101D that it has applied to criminal cases all along. In other words, the Pruitt is just mistaken. The question is, what significance do we give to that?
I'm aware of the advisory committee rules. I read them differently as suggesting that going forward, it's better to confine Pruitt and other cases like Manco in the Second Circuit to the facts as they existed. Reading Manco, reading Pruitt, it's not clear to me from the language in those opinions that the court, either the Second or the Seventh Circuit, was attempting to confine it to those particular facts. I mean, Manco and both Pruitt were speaking to a broader principle that, you know, an accurate determination in criminal cases supersedes any public policy favoring the settlement of civil disputes. I mean, in this particular case, I think that there's just no reason. I mean, even the advisory committee notes to the prior Rule 408, I mean, suggest that the public policy argument is really only applicable when one of the parties or an inference is being drawn against the party to the case. In this particular case, it was a settlement against Mr. Worth, who was Rohde's bankruptcy counselor. And if a negative inference is being drawn here against Worth, there's no harm. Worth is not a party to the case. It would have no preclusive effect on Worth in the future. If anything, I mean, the court should be concerned about Mr. Rohde's welfare, not Mr. Worth's. In this particular case, the district court, even in its post-trial order, recognized that had there been an admission of liability or admission of wrongdoing on Worth's part, that a strong case could be made for inclusion even under Pruitt. As an alternative basis, the court was also arguing that Rule 403 should act to exclude it. And I disagree with the district court's conclusion there.
Disagreement is not the standard of review.
It was an abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
Why was it an abuse of discretion?
Well, 403 still favors inclusion. I mean, the test is whether or not it's substantially outweighed. In this particular case, in the district court's post-trial order, it was relying really on a confusion argument that the mere fact of settlement would have...
thought the district court might well have excluded it under Rule 402. I don't even see why it's relevant. Could you explain why it's relevant?
The crux of Mr. Rohde's defense, the entire body of Mr. Rohde's defense, is that he was following a plan that was devised by his bankruptcy counsel, Mr. Wirth.
Yes, I understand that, but there are two possibilities. One possibility is that his bankruptcy lawyer and he were engaged in a criminal conspiracy. That is, the bankruptcy lawyer and the defendant shared this plan to hide assets. The other possibility is that the bankruptcy lawyer was fooling Rohde in some way, or was off on a lark of his own. And I don't see how the settlement by the bankruptcy lawyer helps us to distinguish between these two possibilities. He would settle, I would think, in either event, and therefore it doesn't make one of the possibilities more likely than the other. That's the relevance problem.
With respect to the first point, I don't believe that the government ever argued that there was any type of criminal conspiracy between Mr. Wirth and Mr. Rohde. With respect to the second, I believe that it is a permissible inference for Mr. Rohde's trial lawyer to get up and argue to the court that Mr. Wirth paid money, he was making a sort of tacit admission that he did something wrong here, that he gave bad advice.
On your view, there are three possibilities. One is Wirth fools Rohde. Second is Rohde fools Wirth. Third possibility is Rohde and Wirth are in a criminal conspiracy together. It seems to me Rohde settles because he's culpable in two and negligent in one. He settles in all three situations. Again, this is my relevance question. How does the settlement help to distinguish which of these now three possibilities is the correct one?
I would suggest that, I mean, Mr. Rohde is just trying to create reasonable doubt here. And in his closing argument, he can get up and say, Wirth paid money. And certainly there are other possibilities. I mean, the government's free to argue that it was a settlement of a nuisance lawsuit or settlement for other reasons. But the jury could infer.
Evidence does not become relevant just because it helps a lawyer throw dust in the jury's eyes. You have to tell a rational story about how the settlement would help to distinguish among these three possibilities. What's that story?
Well, I believe that the test of relevance is, if believed, does it help Rohde? And these are specific intent crimes. If the jury doesn't believe that Rohde knowingly and fraudulently engaged in this course of conduct, and the more likely the jury is to believe...
You're not addressing my question, counsel. My question is how the settlement helps the jury distinguish among the three possibilities. I know perfectly well what the elements of the offense are.
Of course, Your Honor. I mean, the short answer is I don't know. I mean, I don't know in particular, I mean, how it would help them distinguish between a conspiracy among them. I mean, Mr. Rohde is on the stand. He tells that Mr. Wirth told me to do this, I did this. I mean, I don't understand, I mean, how the mere fact of settlement, I simply can't distinguish between the three possibilities. I mean, I would only suggest that Mr. Rohde's counsel should have been entitled to elicit the jury to make the inference that when Mr. Wirth paid money, that he was making an admission of wrongdoing, and in doing so, the jury is more likely to believe Mr. Rohde's defense. I see my white line on. I'd like to save my remaining few seconds for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Burstein. Ms. Kump.
May it please the Court, Catherine Kump for the United States. The district court did not abuse its discretion in ruling that evidence that the defendant had settled his malpractice suit against his bankruptcy attorney inadmissible under Federal Rule of Evidence 403. As the advisory committee notes to Federal Rule of Evidence 408 recognize, evidence of the mere fact that a settlement occurred is in fact irrelevant, as that settlement may be motivated by a desire for peace rather than any admission of wrongdoing or any admission of the validity of the plaintiff's claims. Accordingly, the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding that whatever little probative value that evidence of the settlement may have had, if it had any at all, and we agree that in this case it did not, that any probative value would be far outweighed by the danger that the jury would be misled or confused by evidence of the settlement and the testimony that would have been necessary to explain the settlement into believing that the lawsuit was really a question about what advice, if any, Mr. Wirth gave Mr. Rohde with respect to this bankruptcy. Accordingly, the district court did not abuse its discretion, and the defendant cannot show that he was prejudiced by any ruling under Rule 408. You referred earlier to the amendments to Federal Rule of Evidence 408. This also demonstrates that the defendant cannot show reversible plain error under the district court's ruling under 408. The amendments now require, in every single case, that evidence of settlement evidence like that Mr. Rohde wanted to present be excluded in criminal cases. Given the fact that every district court is...
Why was Wirth not prosecuted?
I'm not sure that there's evidence of that in the record, but the...
There are really only two possibilities for Wirth. One is that he's as much a crook as Rohde, if not more. I mean, Rohde's claim is that he's more of a crook. Second is that he's a total incompetent who should not be representing real people in court. I looked him up on the ARDC website and was stunned to see that he's authorized to practice law and that no disciplinary complaint has ever been filed against him, including, of course, by Rohde's lawyers.
Yes, Your Honor. We don't think that there's evidence in the record that shows that Mr. Wirth himself was culpable. There is, of course, the possibility that he was negligent, but that's not in the record.
That'd be worse than negligent.
He could be completely incompetent.
He has his head very firmly in a deep layer of sand.
Yes, Your Honor. It's quite possible that Mr. Wirth gave the defendant bad advice because he misunderstood the legal principles at issue. But regardless what advice Mr. Wirth gave his client, the defendant can't show plain error here, given the amendments to the rules. The fact that in every single case the district court is required to apply Rule 408, as the district court applied it in this case, makes clear that there's no substantial effect on the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings.
Saying that the court is obliged to apply Rule 408 seems a little weird, given our holding in Pruitt. Pruitt may be wrong. Obviously, the advisory committee and the Supreme Court don't agree with it for the future, but I don't see how the district court was not obliged to apply Pruitt.
Regardless whether the district court was obliged to apply Pruitt in this case, the defendant can't show reversible plain error because he cannot show, even assuming that it was error not to apply Pruitt, that there's a substantial effect on the fairness and integrity of judicial proceedings here because the exact result that happened in this case is now required in every single case. So given the amendments to the rule, the defendant
cannot...
And
besides, it wasn't relevant.
And in addition, Your Honor, we agree that the district court properly ruled under 403 that even assuming there's some small relevance to this evidence, that it would be misleading to the jury and that would far outweigh any probative value. Additionally, the defendant cannot show any effect on his substantial rights, which would be required as the third prong of plain error, because he was not prevented from presenting his theory of the defense to the jury. He was free to call Mr. Wirth to the stand if he wished to, and at that point the settlement may have been admissible. So again, he cannot make the showings necessary to demonstrate reversible plain error, even assuming that the district court was incorrect in failing to apply Pruitt. Are there any further questions?
Seems not. Thank you, Ms. Kump.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Burstein?
Yes, sir.
Just about a point we were discussing before, I mean, Your Honor, the committee notes, including for the recently amended rule, are only applicable to harmless error analysis because, as Your Honor notes, the issue should be analyzed according to law at the time of trial. And the notes are not dispositive on a harmless error issue. I would like to draw attention to the court's sort of overarching commands about permitting defendants to present a complete defense, even in light of clear rules of evidence. And with respect to the government's argument, I just would like to note that the appropriate standard of review is still in dispute in this case. Mr. Rohde contends that his trial lawyer did make a timely objection when the 408 issue was on the table, and that such abuse of discretion is the appropriate standard. If there are no questions, Your Honor, I'd remain silent.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burstein.
Thank you.
Mr. Mikva, we appreciate your willingness and that of the University of Chicago's clinic to accept the appointment in this case. and the assistance you've been to both your client and the court, although I do note that Northwestern brought a larger delegation. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in a brief recess before calling the sixth case.